Hi, this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Late last night, Governor Phil Scott and Democratic leaders at the State House were not able to reach an agreement on how to deal with teacher health care contracts, and so lawmakers passed their budget and went home. It's no secret what the governor's next step will be.
I've been clear that we have an obligation to taxpayers to ensure we have the mechanisms in place to maximize the education health care savings available without costing school employees more. And that has not yet been accomplished. Therefore, I cannot support the budget or the yield bill.
Why was it so hard to find a compromise on the teacher health care issue? And what happens next? With us today to discuss the latest developments at the State House are three of Vermont's best political reporters. With us, Alicia Freese of 7 Days, Kyle Madura of WCAX Channel 3 News, and Neil Goswami, who is bureau chief at the Vermont Press Bureau. Great to have you all here to help us sort out what's going on over at the State House. It was a late night. In the early part of the evening, there were signals that all sides were at least talking to each other, Kyle. Maybe they were making some progress, and then word came, no deal. How close did they get, and why basically did it not happen?
There just seems to be this fundamental fault line between where the governor wanted to go and where the House and the Senate were willing to go, and even really a pretty substantial divide between the House and the Senate on some of these sorts of things. So once it became clear that this impasse that had been talked about the day before, there were still some chats going on despite the use of that word, which we all found a little bit ironic. But once it became clear that there wasn't going to be a three-way deal, it also became clear that the House and the Senate couldn't fundamentally agree on a really good mechanism to claw back some of this cash that everyone seemed to agree was out there, but no one could find common ground on how to grab it. And so they essentially defaulted to what they would have landed on had this idea never come forward a few weeks ago, and had they just wrapped up the session as we were all anticipating at the start of May. So there's an agreement that the cash is out there. They just can't figure out yet how to grab it all.
So the cash might be out there?
The cash is out there, but how much exactly, the best way to grab it, whether to formally demand the $26 million or $13 million on a half-year basis that the governor put out there, or whether to just let the locals kind of collect it and then put that back into their budgets come next year when they're going to voters and kind of informally lower the property tax rates at the local level, that's the real fundamental divide here.
So, Alicia, is the real divide, as Kyle was saying, the governor insisting that there be a statewide teachers contract for health care, and lawmakers saying, no, no, we want that to be done at the local level?
Yeah, I think that gets to the root of the disagreement. I mean, the governor has said it doesn't have to be a statewide contract, but the only alternative that he publicly released to that was writing into law that all school districts accept the same contract, which in my mind is functionally the same thing. You're just going about it in a different way. And the legislative leaders have consistently said, you know, they've actually said we're open-minded to moving in that direction, but that is too big of a chain to change too quickly. That's something we really need to think through. So they were definitely not willing to remove the control from the local district level this session.
And Neil, was it really a three-way negotiation between the House, the Senate, and the governor? Because at one point, didn't the House come very close to supporting the governor's plan?
It definitely was a three-way deal here. And they were all after different things. And the biggest challenge, I think, was in the House, where you have 150 people, very differing views. And Speaker Mitzi Johnson faced, I think, the biggest challenge in trying to navigate something through that chamber. I think she, on Monday evening, she presented a plan to the governor that the unions hated. It put really strict parameters on what teachers could bargain for in terms of their health care benefits. And had the governor agreed to accept it, she would have been in a really tight spot. Democrats hated it. The unions hated it. It had no chance of going through the House, through the Senate. And if the House had put it on the floor, there's a real chance that Republicans, independents, and a handful of Democrats would have pushed it through, which is probably not the best case scenario for a Republican Speaker of the House. So you really had three entities that had three different viewpoints, and they just couldn't find the sweet spot in the end. And so we'll all be back in a few weeks.
And that was just the kind of last manifestation of the split, right? Because you had initially, after the House and Senate kind of seeming like they were on separate pages, they came together and said, okay, we've got this proposal that we're going to move forward with. And then the very next morning, the Senate is changing it. This is the so-called Ash Amendment. Senate is frantically changing it to try to appease the governor. And then the House, it turns out, that proposal probably never had support.
Yeah, and dead on arrival.
And so there you go again. I mean, it was just like one after another. I mean, I don't know if they ever found anything.
I mean, it seems feasible that the House and the governor could have potentially found an agreement they could have gotten on board with, or the Senate and the governor, or the Senate and the House perhaps might have been actually the most intractable if you're appeasing the governor in it all. But finding one all three could get behind.
You still had that fundamental issue in the House and Senate about keeping bargaining at the local level. And for all intents and purposes, the governor seems to have made clear that his main aim was to change bargaining, and bonus if he got savings for property taxpayers as well.
Which is a shift for him, because earlier he told us the $26
million. And if you ask the administration directly, they'll say, no, it's about the savings. But I think their actions in the last 2 weeks show that fundamentally it was about altering the bargaining process.
Well, both House Speaker Mitzi Johnson and Senate President Tim Ash both say the governor introduced this idea of a state teachers' health care contract very late in the session. If he was serious about the idea, he should have proposed it much, much sooner. Here's Senator Ash last night.
There wasn't a full proposal until well after all the deadlines had passed, for reasons best explained by others. But the fact is, if you don't have a legislative process to review really complicated policies, the question is, what is the point of the legislature at all?
And Speaker Johnson said she didn't think this dispute was really about teachers' health care.
I think this wasn't ever at its heart about saving the taxpayers' money. It was about really undermining those local conversations and working Vermonters. We've really worked to bring as many ideas and compromises to the table as possible, and we don't have much of a negotiating partner, and that's unfortunate.
Now, the governor says this idea that he brought the plan up late in the session simply is not true. He says he talked about these savings from the teachers' health care contract in his budget address. He's discussed it several times since then. We got this email from Paul, who wrote, Governor Scott made his proposal to have teachers pay 20% of their health insurance as far back as January. Why did it get put off until the end of the session? Were lawmakers afraid to touch it? I support the governor's tenacity and hope he sees this proposal through to fruition. But Alicia, I do remember the governor talking about savings in health care in his budget address, but some people don't think the specifics, the details, this means a statewide teacher's health care contract, really didn't emerge until much later.
I don't think you can deny that the governor dropped the proposal very, very late in the process. And yes, he alluded to this idea several times earlier in the session. But if there was a full-fledged proposal, it was never publicly released. And, you know, you've got the legislative leader saying, we didn't know about it. I think that's kind of an attempt to rewrite history.
I think this is the one thing that infuriates Democratic leaders in the legislature the most. They're unquestionably, the governor did discuss this in big, broad strokes. You cannot deny that. But the governor and his team, you know, filled with a couple of pretty seasoned political operatives, know that, especially when the legislature is led by another party, if you do not put your plan on paper in legislative language and put it before them, it's not, you know, they're under no obligation to take up something that you allude to. If he had put it on paper, legislative language, and said, we really want this, please consider it, they would have a much stronger argument to make at this point. But, you know, I think Democratic leaders are right in the fact that they didn't have a full-fledged plan on paper. And the governor is also right in saying that he did talk about it. But talking about it and really pushing for a specific proposal are two very different things.
I think one of the reasons we saw this come so late is because there seemed to be this political wake from the failed proposal from the governor to hold school boards at level funding throughout the year. And so when the governor was finally willing to say, okay, yeah, I recognize that's not going to happen, that's when we really started hearing at press conferences about potential VHI savings. But I know all of us have at various times said, okay, but how do you get those savings? And that's where this really lacked an actual proposal, because he'd just say, well, I think it's there. He wouldn't say, well, I think we capture it in this way.
It's almost as if they were grasping to their plan that was dead on arrival for so long in terms of shifting costs from the general fund to the education fund, and then very late in the game decided to take this VHI savings plan to the mat instead and sort of fight over that.
I mean, I think it very nearly could have worked out for him dropping the proposal late in the game, right? Because, I mean, when you've got the legislative leader saying, oh, we don't have time, like, I don't know how well that plays with the public.
Oh,
I mean,
I don't think it does at all.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense to people in the building who are really well-versed in the legislative process. But it kind of sounds like an excuse outside the building.
Well, and it stole a lot of the oxygen in the room in the last few weeks of this session, especially given how slow of a session it has felt like at times, with some big important issues moving through, but not the variety of things that everyone's waiting to see tied up in a nice little knot at the end.
Today on the program, we've got a reporters' roundtable looking at what's happening at the State House. The session ended last night, but lawmakers will be back on June 21st for a veto session. Let's talk to John in Stratford. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much. Couple things. First, you know, we should remember that Act 46 was finalized after the deadlines, in the last minute, and it's kind of, you know, whose program it is depends upon the timing. Secondly, even more important, is there's a lot of unmet needs that in recent years the legislature has tried to wrap up things and put it in a budget, and then there's always a budget hole. This year, we did not make any provisions for funding the Lake Champlain cleanup. We did not make any provisions for funding the underfunded teachers retirement fund. The fact is that this unique opportunity, the most important thing about it is it provides a source of revenue to meet some of our unfunded needs. And unless we take advantage of this, then what will happen is next year, just like the Senate budget, there'll be efforts to raise property taxes to cover teacher retirement funds or other needs. You know, finally, the other big dog in this room, and the one that's showing intransigence, is the Vermont NEA. There was a good article in Vermont Digger about how the VTNEA spends around $1 million a year on seven field operatives that are actually each paid about the same amount as the governor to negotiate teachers' contract with volunteer school boards. There are so many good reasons why the governor's proposal is good. Let's go to a statewide thing. Let's allow teachers, administrators, school board members to concentrate on the real issues that they should be, which is educating our kids.
Okay, John, thanks very much for your phone call. So, Neil, folks who are listening or who might agree with John are saying, you know, the teachers union, they've got these high price negotiators. They're going up against these poor little local school boards. It's really not fair. The school boards are unmatched in this. But that's not exactly the situation, is it?
To some extent, it is. And to another extent, it's not. I mean, there's no question the NEA has a very professional operation in terms of helping local bargaining units at the table. But it would be insincere to say that the school boards are, you know, country bumpkins who are ill-prepared to sit at the same table. They are represented in most cases by some of the best lawyers in Vermont. The school boards association, the superintendents association are a professional they're professional outfits as well, and they also have resources. So is the NEA a very powerful entity, and do they have a really good operation in terms of helping teachers negotiate? Absolutely. But I don't think it's fair to say that school boards are just massively outgunned either.
One issue we were talking about earlier is, how do most Vermonters outside of Montpelier view this dispute? Well, this week the governor said he thinks he has the support of a majority of Vermonters on this issue.
Outside of this building, there might be this vortex here surrounding the State House. But outside the State House, there's a constant wind of support for what I'm proposing.
Alicia, what do you think? Do you think folks outside Montpelier view this issue a little differently than folks within the State House?
I think that's a fair assessment. And I think you would even see some acknowledgement among the Democrats who were lining up behind the teachers' union that they were kind of losing the messaging battle publicly. I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, as the details of the teachers' health insurance plans were being discussed, would compare them to their plans and be like, hey, they're already getting a really good deal. Like, what's the big deal about moving to an 80-20 premium split and getting, you know, out-of-pocket costs for the most part covered? So I do think the governor won the outside-the-building battle.
He definitely has public sentiment in his favor at the moment. I think what's really interesting is we essentially have a month-long mini-campaign about to take off here between now and the veto session on June 21st. And for the last couple of weeks, the NEA has been running some radio ads in the Montpelier, Burlington, Chittenden County area. Expect that to continue. I think they will be sort of using social media and organizing teachers and others to sort of get the message out. Democrats, I would think, will be looking to hone a message that they've really lacked over the last 3 weeks.
And that's one of the areas where I'm surprised by last night's outcome as to what was signed off on by both chambers, because one of the areas where we saw some of the public opinion tide shifting was in that Senator Ash was able to characterize the Senate's plan as one that guaranteed the cash to come back and was a potential campaignable item as we head toward this veto session. And yet that wasn't in this final plan. So one of their strongest talking points was eliminated in the deal between the House and the Senate last night.
We also saw midday this really surprising, unexpected development. So U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, who I can't remember the last time he weighed in on state legislative affairs, comes out with this Facebook message saying basically we need to stand behind collective bargaining. So I think that was a really interesting development.
No doubt Governor Scott is a very popular politician in Vermont, but not even Phil Scott, you know, compares to Bernie Sanders here and elsewhere. So if Democrats and the union can harness some of Bernie's magic and maybe even appearance or two by him over the next month, it could be a game changer. Who knows?
Let's talk to Molly in Jericho. Hey, Molly, welcome to the program.
Hi. So it's interesting that you just played that or talked about Bernie Sanders, because what I was going to say is I think, make no mistake, Governor Scott is attacking collective bargaining and unions in general. I think teachers' unions are an easy target because people don't want to pay higher property taxes, so it's a quick way to get at unions. And my second comment is that I am so tired of this race to the bottom in regards to health care. There's this feeling that I don't have it, so you shouldn't have it either, rather than saying we all deserve health care. What can we do to make sure that we don't take it away from somebody else, but bring other people up so that they can have it as well?
Molly, thanks for your phone call. Kyle, the teachers union also got the support of a lot of other labor groups in Vermont for their position. So has this become kind of a statewide labor issue now?
It certainly seems to be developing into that. I was actually kind of surprised that the unions did get on board with the Senate proposal at one point, because in many respects it accomplished a lot of the governor's goals, in that while it would have left open local negotiating to come to a conclusion that they saw fit, it would have made it quite painful to come to any solution that wasn't the governor's. Last night we spoke with Martha Allen, who is the president of the Vermont NEA, following the agreement, and we said, hey, what do you think? And she said, well, I haven't read it yet, but I'm not thrilled about it, because I would have loved to see something like this with the governor on board, and we are concerned that this ultimately goes to a veto showdown. And I said, well, but this is better than what the governor put out there yet, right? And she said, oh, yes, absolutely. So it we're hearing a lot about Scott Walker, obviously. I think that's a little bit of a hyperbolic comparison.
Governor of Wisconsin.
Governor of Wisconsin, who pulled back on some of the collective bargaining rights back in 2011 there. I think that's a little bit hyperbolic given the extent of what was done in Wisconsin. But the slippery slope argument comes out, and that can be a hard argument to really refute in a substantial way.
The future is also uncertain here in Vermont, though, for especially the teachers union. The House and Senate, what they passed last night, looks to end all teacher contracts on September 1st, 2019, so that a commission that they created to look at implementing a statewide teacher health care benefit, or perhaps statewide negotiation, could be looked at and perhaps implemented then. So, you know, Democrats have really taken some steps that if you're a union member or if you're a teacher, you're looking at and wondering what is the future for us.
Which undercuts one of the governor's better points as to why we have to act now, because
right.
It's a one-off.
They're trying to create a second bite at the apple, essentially.
So the question is, what happens now? June 21st, we have a veto session. I think a lot of people feel that the veto could be overridden in the Senate, but there's no way that it's going to be overridden in the House. So, Kyle, at the end of June 21st, where are we?
Well, that's interesting, because presumably the Republicans in the House will keep their numbers. They were looking at vacation days last night, even trying to make sure that they would have the necessary bodies to sustain the governor's veto. But changing the calendar to June doesn't magically change the impasse that these three sides are looking at. So in the intervening time, presumably leadership in the House and the Senate will be working with the governor to find a conclusion. I did chat with the governor's chief of staff last night, saying, are we now engaged in a political game of chicken here? Because if we hit July 1st, the start of a new fiscal year, and there's no new budget, they're going to need a Washington-style continuing resolution to keep the key elements of government functioning as this fight plays out. Now, the chief of staff of the governor, Jason Gibbs, says, no, we're not going there. It's not going to come to that. But the nuclear option is now on the table. It's staring everyone in the face, and an obvious resolution has yet to present itself. So they come back in 3 weeks with the same situation they were facing yesterday.
I was speaking to the pro tem this morning, and he said, we've basically got to come back to the table June 21st with a solution in hand. I mean, they do not want to be back in the situation where they're kind of floundering in real time. So he said, we need to take a little time off, heal our wounds. That's my language, not his. But I think there are some hard feelings right now. And then there'll be meetings all over again with the speaker, the pro tem, and the governor.
Well, and I think there's a feeling, especially from Senator Ash, that being able to do this without the press corps sitting right outside the door of the governor's office or outside the speaker's office will make it easier, because every time we force them to say, all right, what are your hard stops? What are your negotiations calling for? Where's the differences here? It locks them into a box of what they then have to stick with moving forward. So I think there's a feeling that if they can do this a little bit outside the public eye, there might be some more wiggle room. Available.
Although I would argue they did a pretty good job of doing it outside the public eye, inside the state house.
Absolutely.
And Neil, you know, let's say we get to June 21st and there's no agreement. We're looking at a new budget going into place July 1st. All of a sudden, Montpelier is going to start looking like Washington, D.C.
I mean, there's a danger of that. I think probably some people look to Montpelier and think it already is that way. But, assuming that we do get the veto that has been promised, everyone is under pressure. The governor shares just as much burden and responsibility as lawmakers do at that point. So presumably everyone is sort of incentivized to move a little bit more, and perhaps that's just what is needed to get a deal across the line. You know, if you listen to the administration, it was lawmakers who were unwilling to budge. If you listen to lawmakers, it was the administration unwilling to budge at the end. So when they're all under the gun, under the same pressure, they all have to move a little bit more. And that maybe that's the key here.
Let's talk to Lee in Colchester. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob and everybody. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a couple things to mention, actually. First of all, you know, the governor's plan included up to $50 million of the savings potential towards health savings accounts for teachers to make them whole in lieu of increased out-of-pocket exposure with his 80-20 plan. But it's not clear to me whether any of the plans put forth by the Senator of the House included anything like that, or if that was just going to be thrown to school boards to magically come up with ways to make the teachers whole again. Second, I also thought it was perhaps a bit ironic that back when Governor Shumlin was pushing for a single payer in Vermont, that the teachers' unions were all in favor of it, given that, you know, he was putting forth a 90%+ actuarial value single payer plan, even with promises by Governor Scott to keep the teachers whole, they're totally against it. I don't see why that statewide plan from the Shumlin administration is so much better than the statewide teachers' health plan put forward by Governor Scott. Can your panel please comment?
Okay, Lee, thanks very much. Neil?
I mean, I don't know why the NEA would be for one thing and not the other. I mean, we're talking about they're very different proposals. What Governor Shumlin was seeking was a health insurance program that would cover everyone by virtue of just being a Vermonter.
And part of the reason his plan was so expensive is because they did peg the actuarial value in that single payer system to what state employees and teachers might expect to have available to them and what they had had, and that's much higher than much of the public is used to.
Right. It was essentially bringing many people up to a closer level to what the teachers were experiencing. So, I mean, in some ways, yes, it is a statewide thing, but, you know, we're talking about apples and oranges in my view here.
And to his first question on whether the House or the Senate would make teachers whole, the Senate plan specifically would not have done that, though I do believe they anticipated that while the Scott administration says we'll save $75 million, we'll pour $50 million back into making them whole, I think they presumed that that would happen at the local level as part of meeting that proportional share of the $26 million. So by saying the lower bar, the idea was that these boards would be able to negotiate some of that kickback in.
One of the things that I think was fairly constant in all of the different proposals is they were working off what was known as the gold plan offered by VHI to teachers. Which, you know, including an 80-20 premium split and keeping a $400 max out-of-pocket cost for teachers. So I do believe in all of the plans that were kicked back and forth between the governor and legislative leaders, they were dealing with the same parameters.
Well, let's shift gears and look at another bill that could face a veto threat, and that's the marijuana legalization bill. It's on its way to the governor. He's got 5 days to make a decision about that. The bill includes the approach taken in the House, which allows individuals to possess up to an ounce of marijuana and grow several plants. It also sets up a commission to study the approach taken in the Senate, which is to have a state regulatory system, including retail stores and the taxation of marijuana. That commission is set to issue its report in November. Any recommendations would be subject to further legislative approval. So the governor has three options. He can sign it, he can veto it, or it can become law without his signature. The governor's phone line is being flooded by supporters and opponents of the bill. The $64,000 question is, what will Governor Scott do? Alicia, what do you think?
How did I get saddled with that one?
You were even looking away, trying to avoid it.
I feel confident in saying it's unlikely that he's going to sign it. And as far as whether or not he lets it pass into law without his signature, or whether he vetoes it. I mean, I'd really be guessing. I do think what we saw last night with his pledge to veto two significant bills, the budget and the education tax bill, I think that puts some more pressure on him to avoid a veto in this case. And I also think that there has been a pretty significant outcry from the public calling for this. So I think politically, he's got an incentive to let it pass.
Neil, what do you think?
I think Alicia's probably right. The public polling that we have on this issue shows that a majority of Vermonters do want to see legalization here in Vermont. On the other hand, presumably the folks in the minority do include a lot of educators, a lot of law enforcement personnel, and those are difficult conversations for the governor to have with people who are respected in their communities but opposed to marijuana legalization. But this isn't really a Democratic or Republican issue. It's across party lines. So if he vetoes it, he risks alienating some of his Republican supporters as well. Probably, I'd just be guessing as well, but I would think the most likely thing he would do is let it become law without his signature and speak about why he is hesitant and doesn't think it's the best idea.
And this is some of the political pain the governor will have to endure, making this choice that it didn't look like he would have to make because he dropped the teacher's health care plan on the table at the last minute.
Right.
The delays in getting out that were born out of that discussion allowed the legislature the time to come up with this surprise compromise agreement that none of us really saw coming until a couple days ahead of it. And so there's a potential issue for the governor here in that if he wants the public to take his vetoes on the education tax bill as well as the budget seriously, he could potentially lose some credibility if he then vetoes this bill. That being said, he has been out there with his concerns about public safety, kids getting it in their hands. But because this wouldn't take effect until July 2018, there's also the potential that he could thread the needle there and say, all right, well, as long as I can get agreement from the legislature that we're going to tackle some of those issues in the intervening months between January of next year and July 2018, that might potentially allow him to say, well, we've got a pledge to address my concerns.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, a reporter's roundtable looking at the events and issues at the State House. With us today, Neil Goswami, who is bureau chief of the Vermont Press Bureau, Alicia Freese of 7 Days, and Kyle Madura of WCAX Channel 3 News. We've been talking about what will Governor Scott do with this marijuana legalization bill. Well, last week on this program, the governor made it very clear that he really hasn't made up his mind yet on this. For instance, he made comments that indicated he might sign the bill.
I have this libertarian streak in me that says you should be able to do whatever you want in your own home as long as it doesn't create any harm for others. Maybe it's Yankee independence. Maybe it's the libertarian streak. But I get that part.
But the governor also made comments that he might veto it because he's convinced that lawmakers next year will adopt the recommendations of the study commission and have Vermont adopt the Colorado retail approach.
It's clear that we're not just studying it. We're going to do it from their perspective. I just believe that there are other ways that we can do this. I think it's a big deal. We've got to get this right, and we should take the time to do so.
The governor also indicated that letting the bill become law without a signature was a path he is considering.
I can't put my head in the sand. It's going to happen at some point. Massachusetts and Maine have both determined that they're going to legalize. Canada is talking about this as well. So we're going to have to determine some of those issues before too long.
So the House and the Senate really have taken different approaches on this issue. The House with the personal possession approach, the Senate wanting the state regulatory model. Kyle, why are they so different on this issue? I mean, they couldn't be more different on what they would like to see the state do for the legalization of marijuana.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we've seen the Senate plan essentially go to the House twice now. And last year, I believe it only had about 20 votes in favor in the 150-member, a little bit more than that, but in the 150-member House. This year, I believe it got 44. So we're seeing the House start to slowly come around to the idea that the Senate's been in favor of the tax and regulate retail model that's out there. This year on the Judiciary Committee in the House, they had several different members, and that really changed the complexion in order to get them to the libertarian model that they were able to convince the Senate to go along with, at least for the time being, of personal possession being legal, growing a couple plants being legal, but not the full-on dispensary situation that we've seen in Colorado and elsewhere. It's more the D.C. model. The divide is really interesting. I think it's hard to come up with a good reason as to why it's so different. But I will say the Senate has also shown itself to be the slightly more liberal body in recent years, which may help explain it. And I think you've got big chunks in the House that do favor legalization in some form, but they – within the House – that faction is split amongst itself as to which one is the smartest approach. I will say the way they're going forward now fits into how they handled medical marijuana way back when and in the intervening year since, in that it's a baby step followed by a baby step followed by a baby step approach that really avoided some of the issues that were seen in other states when it came to medical marijuana. Given how much faster this is moving nationally, it's unclear if folks will think they can take a slow but steady approach on legalized recreational.
The House position seems to be driven by the priority set by the House Judiciary Committee, which was criminal justice reform, and really trying to find some parity within our drug laws here in Vermont. On the Senate side, I think they also have a desire to see some criminal justice reform. But you also have more members starting to accept that if you want to include the education and prevention efforts that everybody wants, if you want to include more drug recognition experts, you really have to have a revenue source that helps fund it. And so a tax and regulate market does create some revenue source to get you there. But Kyle's right. You know, this was the most they could get in an incremental step through both chambers. And so that's where we are.
Alicia, do you think that the governor's biggest issue is driver impairment?
Yeah, I think that seems to be what he's mentioned most consistently throughout this session and on the campaign trail. I mean, I think he's also cited the, concerns about youth and the wanting education and prevention measures in place. But the driving thing does seem to be primary for him.
And Bob, you mentioned the governor is undecided. He has that luxury for 5 more days. The bill was delivered to the governor yesterday by Senate Secretary John Bloomer. The clock starts today. Today is day one. Sunday doesn't count. So Wednesday at midnight, he'll have to decide what he's going to do.
Which in itself was an interesting tactical choice from the Senate, because as we've seen in recent years, the governor can frequently say, hey, hold on to the bill for a few weeks so that we can do this nice big signing. We can take our time to review it. This was clearly a couple key leaders in the Senate saying, we want to force this issue. We're sending it to you as soon as we can.
And Kyle, it's interesting. If you look at the states that have dealt with this issue, it's all been done by voter referendum process. Vermont would be the first state in the country to do it through a legislative process. In this debate, are we kind of seeing the reasons why?
Well, I think, especially in the previous few years, the discussion was, well, let's see how it goes in Colorado. Let's see how it goes elsewhere. Now we've got areas nearby that are starting to go. So you've got Massachusetts, you've got Maine, you've got Canada that's going in that direction. And so that's potentially starting to force some of the issue. The data that has come out of these other states, one side will say it means X, the other side will say it means Y. So we're not necessarily getting the clarity that would have been hoped for by some of these lawmakers. But certainly they're moving forward because they feel like It's just a matter of time, and we might as well do this the Vermont way and do it in this matter, not only because the voters care, but because they'd rather think about it, consider it. I mean, last year when they passed it, the Senate was the first Senate in the country to pass something. I believe one other house has passed something. But now to get through two chambers, it certainly sets Vermont out for one of those. We have so many first in the nation legislative maneuvers that we've come to be known for.
And, Neil, I think you were alluding to this earlier, but the governor could let this bill become law without his signature. Mm-hmm. See the work of the commission. And if he doesn't like where the commission is going, he can always veto whatever the commission recommends next year. And then what that would leave in place is personal possession
right.
in July of 2018?
2018, July 1st, 2018. You know, the commission is tasked with coming up with legislation, but it's, you know, the commission has no authority to implement a regulated market here in Vermont. Lawmakers will still have to come back and pass it. We've seen some movement in the House, but as Kyle noted, only 44 members voted out of 150. So they still have a ways to go in the House to get enough support to pass it. So who knows? Maybe the governor, he probably should be worried that that's where they're heading, because I think eventually everyone realizes that's where we are headed. But it may not be 2018 that it comes to fruition.
And what's interesting about the commission is we just had the RAND report on marijuana legalization and a path forward come out a couple of years ago. So while the commission's out there and that sounds like better branding than a study committee in that it's anticipated that lawmakers would be more likely to act upon it, it's not like many anticipate a different finding than the right. one we got a couple of years ago.
And the governor, focusing on driver impairment, Kyle, some folks have been asking us really all winter and spring, isn't there a test for this? Isn't there something like DUI for alcohol?
So right now, essentially the test that looks at impairment is more comparable to a field sobriety test that folks would likely be familiar with out in the field when it comes to DUI. There is not a breathalyzer equivalent, though, that can really say with good accuracy whether someone is truly impaired or whether they simply have marijuana in their system. There are blood tests that come once someone has been arrested for suspicion, but the main weight of determining whether someone is impaired on the roadway under drugs really does come in that field sobriety style test that does seem to have some pretty fair science behind it.
And we do get convictions now for DUI drugs, so I mean on some level it does work.
But we don't have many DREs, so it's not like every trooper or policeman out there is trained to do this. There are about, I think it's like 40 in the state. So it takes some time for them to get there.
Yeah.
And Alicia, is this a big political decision for the governor as well?
Well, I was just thinking about that. Like, how does pushing it off until next year change the political dynamic? And I don't know. I mean, do you guys have thoughts on whether will he be more reluctant to do it next year?
I think, as Kyle noted, the one-year delay does allow him to make the case that, well, we have some time to work on road safety issues and education and prevention. And I think that was by design. Also, it was by design to give everyone more time to make that case and also give the commission time to look at tax and regulate.
And I think there's a thought that the House simply takes longer to deliberate over these things, and so more time will sway more members.
So if the governor does veto this bill, does it become an issue of debate in the so-called veto session?
I would think not a whole lot of time, because there's really no pathway to override a veto on this in the House.
And if they want to come back in January and do something again, they can. They have the vehicles.
It's going to be fascinating to see what happens with marijuana, with the budget, with teachers' contract. The work of the 2017 session is definitely not over. Lawmakers will be back in Montpelier on June 21st, and we'll be following the issues of this special veto session in the coming days and weeks. Many thanks to our panel today, Alicia Freese of 7 Days, Kyle Madura of Channel 3 News, and Neil Goswami of the Vermont Press Bureau. Really appreciate you coming by and helping us understand these issues better.
Thanks, Bob.
Great
Always
to
a
be
pleasure.
Here.